Sunday afternoon, 29th August 1982. Venerable Sirs and the assembled company, seeking the unborn, unaging, undying, the sorrowless, the stainless, means seeking the transcendent. Finding the transcendent means that he who has sought, because of the utter purification of the entire psychophysical organism, which spells the complete emptiness of the psyche and the stilling of the wheel of imagination, is now the transparent vessel or medium through which the light of transcendence can shine freely. He is the nexus for the free functioning of the creative energy of transcendence. It enters into him, the unresisting one, and flows out of him over his whole environment. If it does not enter into him, he who is the existential being on earth, it cannot clothe itself in an appropriate conceptual and verbal form in which the teaching can be given out. This is where the particular person with his culture, tradition, and language step in with their shaping but limiting influence. You will notice that all the founders of the religions, all the great spiritual teachers, presented things in just their way as such. And this is where the particular manifested individual comes in. When the teaching is given, its transcendent quality is embodied in that divine utterance. Therein lies its power to affect the world. We know as a historical fact that the word of the great spiritual teachers has affected humanity for good, and only for good, for thousands of years. It is the defects of the followers who have adulterated or soured the wine of the spirit, or mixed poison with the ambrosia of immortality, which has brought about all the evil, the horror and misery which has afflicted the nations of the world with wars and devilish cruelty in the name of religion. It is because of that transcendent quality embodied in the teacher's utterances that whoever hears the word, whatever the grade of his ability for understanding and response may be, will find the bread of life which is just right for him at his stage of development. This perhaps is the meaning of the Pentecostal miracle. And note what the Buddha himself says in connection with this. This is the Mahasatchaka Sutta. And he tells Satchaka, whom he addresses as Aggivesana, "Now I, Aggivesana, am aware that when I am teaching Dhamma to companies consisting of many hundreds, each person thinks thus about me. The recluse Gotama is teaching Dhamma especially for me." He hears it in his own terms and his own language. But this Agnivesana should not be understood thus. For when a Tathagata is teaching Dhamma to others, it is for the sake of general instruction. Now, I have sometimes wondered whether the word general in this context means for everybody present. And I, Agnivesana, at the close of such a talk, steady, calm, make one-pointed, and concentrate my mind subjectively in that first characteristic of concentration in which I ever constantly abide. Now this is an extremely important statement, in which I ever constantly abide. The first characteristic of concentration, the note says, Samadhi Nimitta, explained in the commentary in the second volume, as concentration on the fruit of voidness, the Shunyata Phala Samadhi. Because of this, I mentioned that the purification process implies that the psyche becomes completely empty. It's transparent to transcendence after that. So, I, the person to whom the Buddha is speaking, will be inspired and filled with the Spirit provided I listen with faith, with that love longing which the Upanishads call the Tadvanam, for the truth that makes all men free, which transmutes me, the subhuman, into the full-fledged, pure and true human, a blissful creator. The teacher, the perfected holy man, who is the tongue of transcendence, speaks the word of truth out of the depth of transcendent consciousness, and with the intensity, a whole-making intensity of creative power. He never speaks down to me or to you. He speaks with the intention and the required skill to lift us up in heart, to enable us to see with dust-free eyes, and to hear with ears so attuned to his harmony that each one of us can softly sound his own pure and special note to swell the divine music sounding through him. If we can understand this and, what is more important, respond to it, then faith will arise and grow and flower in us. Not blind faith, but faith which is born of true insight, panya, which is not a vague intuition, but a shining streak of omniscience, as if it were living lightning standing still. We are changed then into faithful children of our father teacher. Remember, the Buddha himself spoke of Sariputta as the son of his mouth, and also in the Itivuttaka. He says, monks, I am a Brahmin, one to ask a favor of, ever clean-handed, wearing my last body, incomparable physician and surgeon. Ye are my own true sons, born of my mouth. born of Dhamma, created by Dhamma, my spiritual heirs, not carnal heirs. Remember, he had already said that he is the Dhamma Bhuta, the Dhamma become. So he identifies himself with the eternal Dhamma as such. And he calls his monks the sons born of his mouth, because whatever comes out of his mouth is the Dhamma as such. Now it's very interesting to bear in mind that just this kind of thing was put in the Rig Veda, in the 10th book, the 90th hymn, verse 12, if I remember right. The Brahman is, the true Brahman is born out of the mouth of Brahma. The Vaishya, the Kshatriya, the ruling caste, the warrior caste, the administrators and so on, are born out of his arms. The merchant, the shopkeeper group, is born out of his belly, and the workers out of his legs. That's how it is put in the Rig Veda. And I think it is a somewhat similar idea here, only it's not divided up into castes at all. But the Buddha says, ye are my own true sons. What an extraordinary thing to know. That if one can be, if one can live the Buddha Dhamma, one is the true son of the Buddha, the enlightened one. Thereafter, we stay in our Father's house, in any and many of his innumerable mansions, nourished by his wisdom, protected and gladdened by his compassion. Where is my Father's house? Whither shall I go to find this Father teacher? Does he live in the west or in the east, in the north or in the south, in icy caves on snow-clad peaks or in burning bushes in desert wastes? Let us stop noisy and useless questioning and be quiet. Sit still and breathe peacefully. Hear now, your own living organism, your present home, is one of the many mansions of the universal house. Look within steadily, silently, without desire, without expectation, free of all preconceptions, of all blinkers on your eyes. Look with your immortal eye, your third eye, and see, there he is, serene, unmoving, rock-seated, right in your inmost heart, his permanent throne, the all-enlightened Buddha, winner of deliverance from all ill. Well may we express our heartfelt homage. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. The Buddha, enthroned in our inmost heart, is invisible to us because we have set our sights on worldliness. We want to get rid of our pains and of what we dislike. We want to possess and enjoy what we desire, sense pleasures, bodily and cultural. the satisfactions of our self-esteem, vanity, egoism, our material and psychological security, our ambitions, whether worldly or spiritual, wearing the cloak of idealism. The enthroned Buddha constantly plays on a drum, the drum of deathlessness, whose sound is quite unlike that of the earthly drums of doom. It is much more like the song of Orpheus, for it could tame a wild elephant and lead the murderous robber Angulimala out of evil to arhantship, and influence India's greatest emperor, Ashoka Maurya of the 3rd century BC, to disband his armies and rule his land by the gentle law of the Buddha. But we do not hear the Buddha's music because the worldly cacophony we make has deafened our ears. The lovely song the Buddha sings, like the three movements of a classical symphony, has three themes: sila, samadhi, panya. But unlike performing the three movements of the earthly symphony in temporal succession, the three themes of the celestial song, the song of liberation, are practiced simultaneously in order to ring the climactic chord of enlightenment. You might wonder, whatever am I talking about? A great composer, I believe it was Mozart, was once asked, "How do you hear the source of your compositions?" And he is reputed to have said, "I hear it as a single chord. That works itself out in the world as all these successive notes and harmonies." I don't know whether this was so or not, but I have a vague memory of having read something like it about 65 years ago. Whether the account is a statement of fact or not, it is profoundly significant in relation to the Buddha and all the great teachers of religion. Every one of them made his positive affirmation of transcendence in some form or other, theistic or non-theistic, personal, impersonal, or transpersonal. An affirmation born of his personal realization of transcendence. The theistic affirmations of transcendence are the Zarathustrian, Judaic, Christian, Islamic, Sikh, and the two Hindu forms, the Shaivite and the Vaishnavite. The non-theistic are the Upanishadic, Brahman Atma, transpersonal, the integration of personal and impersonal, that is, the Tao of Lao Tzu, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, the uncompounded of the Buddha, the Ein Sof of the Kabbalah, the Tad Ekam, that one of the Rig Veda, and the Nirvana of Jainism. Among the affirmations of personal union with or realization of transcendence, the outstanding ones are the Aham Brahmasmi of many Upanishadic teachers, the Ehye Asher Ehye in Exodus, chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, the I and the Father are one of Jesus, many statements by Sri Krishna in the Gita, the Pratyag Atma and Paramatma of Hindu teaching, and the Buddha's affirmation that he is the Dhamma Bhuta or Brahma Bhuta. Notice how often the Buddha uses the word Brahma. It was said earlier that the Holy One speaks the word of truth out of the depths of transcendent consciousness. Let us try to understand this, and or at least obtain the feel of it, even slightly. As we are at present, in what manner are we conscious of our world? Perceiving it through the use of our senses, are we not conscious of it in terms of separate objects or isolated creatures? This chair, that book, this man, that woman, etc. So too with all our activities, pursuits and experiences. This concert or seminar or holiday, this job or game or research, this illness or achievement or piece of good luck, etc. We are conscious of our entire living process as an endless succession of bits and bobs. It is all registered by and stored in the brain as an ever-flowing stream of words. And the same is true of our whole psychical life of thoughts, feelings, moods, wishes, impulses, etc. Above all, we are conscious of ourselves as separate from everything else. Our consciousness is vijnana, discriminative, in the sense of analytic, separative, and isolative. For us, the world is a collection of the countless many, and we are aware that each and every one of the countless many comes into being as a composite thing or creature, has its existence span, and ceases to exist as that identifiable entity. Sabbe sankhara anicca. In other words, the context of the manifested universe is the finite, the temporal, the mortal. This is how we, as we are now, can be conscious of the universe. What the Buddha taught 25 centuries ago finds agreement by some modern scientists regarding the observable universe. To cite one opinion, Edwin L. Turner, professor of astrophysical sciences at Princeton University, has written in Science Digest of January 1982, "Our Earth will become a huge, featureless, cold, iron sphere, then a black hole, and finally evaporate away entirely in an ever-increasing trickle of radiation. As for our universe, if it continues to be an ever-expanding system of galaxies, all matter will eventually disperse, leaving a universe containing slowly fading radiation, ultimately yielding to eternal emptiness in about 10 to the power 1,000 or 2,000 years. Somewhat long period. Although our usual mode of awareness is limited to finitude, temporality, and mortality, there are times when some of us experience freedom from this limitation in some degree or other. The otherness of things and persons in our environment becomes dim even to vanishing point, and the whole environment seems to become very vividly one's own self. And yet, neither oneself, John Smith will call him, nor any person or thing in the environment has lost its discrete individuality. John Smith would not mistake himself for the donkey over there, nor that the sea by the cliff edge is a solid extension of the ground on which he is standing, nor that he is a king canute bathing his feet on the shore. The extension of John Smith's consciousness has made him clearly aware of the intimate relationship between all the contents of his environment, including himself. He has consciously experienced a more inclusive individuality or indivisibility in the supreme sense than his ordinary separative and isolative self-consciousness. When this inclusiveness of consciousness reaches full fruition, the limited context of the finite, temporal, and mortal is transformed into the unlimited context of the infinite, eternal, and immortal. On the way to this culmination, a critical change takes place. The brain ceases to record speech representing the activity of consciousness. The flow of discursive thought, which is a stream of words spoken audibly or silently, stops. We may say that we cease to be conscious of or about something or other. Instead, consciousness is that something or other. When two persons are in this state, communication between mind and mind needs no words. Recall that incident when the Buddha lifted a flower and Kashyapa smiled, and the Mahayana was born, and Jesus giving the sop to Judas. There was a silent communication. We unfortunately think of Judas as a traitor. He wasn't a traitor at all. He fulfilled his particular job in life, his particular destiny. Without Judas's action, there would have been no Christianity. But even a Buddha or any perfected holy one, though he speaks out of the depth of transcendent consciousness, cannot convey the full, meaningful content of his teaching through the medium of speech. Note the nature of these words: infinite, eternal. They negate the context of the finite, etc., without destroying the reality of the finite. This is a very important point to bear in mind. These words, which represent the transcendent, do not negate that which is that which belongs to time, to the realm of death. They negate the context of the finite without destroying the reality of the finite, etc. Not only with respect to your mind or consciousness, but also with respect to the actuality of all existing things and creatures, the so-called inanimate and animate contained in our whole environment. You see what has happened. The false separation between the self and the not-self disappears, and with it so much conflict anxiety, pain, grief. In short, dukkha. Your mode of awareness of existence has transcended all finitude, time, and mortality. The Buddha said to the Brahman Pingala Kocha, it's in the first volume of the Majjhima, page 253, this brahmacharya is not for advantage in gains, honors, fame, in moral habit, concentration, knowledge, and vision. That which is unshakable freedom of mind is the goal of the Brahma faring. This the pith, this the culmination. The infinite, eternal, and immortal is the context of the wholly religious mind, of the perfectly matured consciousness. It is the unborn, the unbecome, the unaging, the undying, the unsorrowing, the stainless. It is transcendence. But transcendence subsumes the entire realm of dukkha. For unless there is a relationship, a conduit, that is, a path, cannot be made leading us out of the mortal into the deathless. There has to be a conduit, and there is no release possible. On each one's shoulders rests the responsibility for building that conduit. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. On the way to this culmination, a critical change takes place. The brain ceases to record speech representing the activity of consciousness. The flow of discursive thought, which is a stream of words spoken audibly or silently, stops. We may say that we cease to be conscious of or about something or other. Instead, consciousness is that something or other. When two persons are in this state, communication between mind and mind needs no words. Recall that incident when the Buddha lifted a flower and Kashyapa smiled. And the Mahayana was born in consequence. And Jesus giving the sop to Judas. Of course, that is understood by the Christian world in quite a different way. Spiritual induction takes place. Krishna, remember, gives the third eye to Arjuna in order to see the supreme truth. Gives the third eye. But even a Buddha or any perfected holy one, though he speaks out of the depth of transcendent consciousness, cannot convey the full, meaningful content of his teaching through the medium of speech. In yesterday's talk, you mentioned the terms belief and faith. How are we to understand these words? It seems to me that real faith is synonymous with knowledge. You know. Ordinarily, one believes something without oneself being fully conscious of it, being fully aware of what it stands for or means. So you hold a belief. But when your own living experience has shown you the truth, you don't need to believe in that way. You have faith, full faith. True faith is devoid of ignorance, of uncertainty. That is how I see it. Now, the other question. You spoke to us yesterday about Mazda. Why is it when the transcendent limits itself, the first thing that is produced is wisdom? I wish I were the embodied transcendence to tell you that. Please.
As I understand it, the only way you can understand the thing is through speech. You yourself have been speaking to tell us all about the faith.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that very clearly.
You said that something cannot be conveyed through speech while you're speaking to us. Well, you are speaking to us yourself, but we are hearing you through speech. So if your speech can't be received to us, we get no knowledge from it, you see. I'm trying to point out that surely speech is all important. Without speech, there would be no message to hear, would there?
Speech is the physical medium, the material medium, by which one tries to convey what is in one's mind to another mind. But the content of the mind, I feel, is much richer than that which is than its representation in words. And words have a way of being misunderstood. If a mind can communicate directly with another mind, and the two minds are developed enough, sensitive enough, for this phenomenon to take place, then it seems to me that the whole truth could be conveyed. Words can easily be misunderstood, because, you see, each person has his own conception as regards the meaning of the word. And that conception in his mind is always different in some degree or other from the other person's mind.
May I say something further? He can recognize these qualities of faith which you've been talking about. He can say to himself, well, what you've been saying when you've been speaking to us, that is what transcendence is like to me. So then he'll be happy, won't he? The transcendent, the cognition of the transcendent, of one mind to another, through the power of words.
Through the power of words?
Yes.
It could happen, perhaps, but I don't know whether the whole thing can happen that way. Can it happen in its fullness? I don't know. Anyone got any ideas? When the psyche is completely pure, completely empty, then the whole reality can be transmitted. And if both psyches are completely empty. The transmission is complete and perfect. You know, the Buddha held up a flower and Kashyapa smiled. And that was all. And there was the transmission from the perfected mind to the perfected mind. The pure mind to the pure mind. And remember that mind in its reality is not a personal property. Psyche is, not mind. Mind in its full sense, in its fullness, is a universal reality. All containing reality. That is mind. Let me come back to this question. You spoke to us yesterday about Mazda. Why is it when the transcendence limits itself, the first thing that is produced is wisdom? You see, we are talking here in a mixed way. When we talk of transcendence, there is no first, second, third, or fourth. The absolute, the supreme totality is the absolute and the supreme totality. We can't divide it up into this, that, or the other. The divisions come in for convenience in talking. But the moment we descend to convenience in talking, we lose some of the wholeness of the thing, you see. So when we say the first thing that is produced? The first thing that is produced is wisdom. Oh yes, in the Kabbalistic teaching, you have Ein Sof, and then you have Chochmah. You know the Kabbalistic terms, do you? Chochmah, wisdom. You see, and Bina, which is intelligence. When we talk, we have to divide and subdivide and so forth. Because that is how our consciousness functions. That is how our senses also function. By dividing, by separating. In the absolute unity, there is absolute silence. Sometimes one feels that in our modern world, if that can be produced for a little while, and the whole world were to be under that spell, we'd have much less trouble afterwards to be absolutely silent. Now, why is wisdom the first emanation out of Ein Sof? You see, that's your question, isn't it? I don't know, I'd have to ask the transcendent why that is the first. I think it's a case of you pays your penny and you takes your choice. Some would like to make it love. Assuming that the person who wants to make it love knows what love really means, which is very, very doubtful. No, I think this is a question which really stumps me as it stands.
I'm still a little unclear, or indeed very unclear, about transcendence. Could you give us a reference where we can read more about it?
When I use the word transcendence, I don't mean transcendence in the sense of outside this, other than. Transcendence is absolute totality. It's in that sense that I use the word transcendence.
Yes, I gathered that, but I wonder if you've expanded on that idea in your essays.
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
Have you expanded on that at all in your book or in your essays?
I know I've used the word transcendence fairly freely right through the book, but I have not attempted to give a sort of a comprehensive definition of it, because after all, no definition can be comprehensive enough to express transcendence, can it? Because transcendence loses its meaning then.
But there's power, transcendence, one of these expressions always used. How would you explain that? Power, transcendent. I've seen it in the Bible. And power, transcendent. I think I've seen that somewhere.
In the Bible?
Somewhere or other.
The light.
That might be in its explicit meaning, but something which passes another.
It's just like saying, give me a definition of God, isn't it?
Yes.
You can't.
Unless, like the child who answered, God is G-O-D. In yesterday's talk, you mentioned the terms belief and faith. How are we to understand these words? Well, I suppose these words can be approached flexibly. Some may give this definition and some may hold another definition. As far as I can see it, faith is synonymous with knowledge. You really know that. When you really know, you have faith in it. Belief something is usually something which has been read or something which has been spoken by another person, and you accept it as being true because that person said it. So it seems to me that belief has a lesser element of certitude in it than faith has. Then, of course, there is this element. If one has complete confidence in somebody, one accepts what that body says completely, without questioning, without challenging it. But then that is not always a reliable certitude. The only reliable certitude is what oneself, the individual, feels certain of. And even that sometimes has to undergo change in the light of further experience and knowledge. You can't avoid that. I have sometimes wondered, I don't know this, so someone who knows philology better than I do, please enlighten me. Belief, to have seems to me to imply to have confidence in some statement or some person who makes the statement and so forth. Is the word belief, splitting it up into leaf and so on, anything to do with allegiance to a liege lord?
On a motto.
Huh?
I think some of the old mottos have my belief, but spelled with an F. Would it spell with an F? Old English. Could have been my whole.
Just L-I-E-F, leaf. Yes, you accept it as being true.
True, yes.
Yes, that's a belief. Perhaps, could this be the difference, that belief has more of an intellectual slant to it, and faith is a whole feeling matter of feeling. But a feeling which is like buddhi, an unerring insight, faith. If there is unerring insight, then you certainly have faith.
Can faith resist examination?
Pardon?
Can it resist examination?
Can it resist examination? Which one, faith or belief? Either of them.
Because it says that if you examine, some will fade away.
Yes, if one examines and is capable of examining it sufficiently deeply, and in that examination what was previously understood or accepted is contradicted, you see, then of course what you say holds.
But you can comment, oh, that was a belief of mine. You never say that was a faith of mine.
Yes. Now, faith has this this sort of emotional timbre to it.
Or spiritual.
Pardon?
Spiritual.
Yes. There is a spiritual content to it, and that is faith.
Yes, faith.
Yes.
Faith has the certainty of knowledge, doesn't it? I know that my Redeemer liveth. I believe that my Redeemer liveth.
Yes, yes, yes. Belief has a certain question mark attached to it. Oh, yes, yes. It's more of the heart. Faith is much more of the heart than of the head.
Could we say that it would be more dangerous?
What?
In faith, in the, I mean...
If your faith is misplaced...
Yes, in a fanatic.
Yes,
in anything
yes,
like that.
Yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. Then you get the... grand cruelties of the world.
So faith is dangerous, can be dangerous. Very dangerous.
You see, some of the most terrible wars in past centuries have been on the grounds of faith, as they call it.
So there is some religions make it a feature.
A feature?
A virtue.
Yes, yes, faith is a virtue, yes.
Yes, yes, but...
But you see, if if faith means something which is completely bound up with love in the real sense, then it cannot hurt. But that happens very, very rarely. See, we have invented all these words and used these words in a limited context, in a limited sense. When one person says to another, I love you. Well, what is the measure? What is the intensity? What is the significance? I was just going to say, what is the eternity of that love? All right, I love you today. A year later, I love somebody else. And say the same thing to that or somebody else. What then? What's happened? I have turned faithless then. Faithless, of course, in that context means without fidelity. Well, anything more we can discuss? Yes, sir.
Can we go back to Robert's question?
Yes.
It might be a chicken and the egg type of question, really. It might be like the chicken or the egg. But surely wisdom is a prerequisite to transcendence, not the other way around.
Wisdom is a prerequisite of transcendence.
Yes, it's not transcendence first and then wisdom, I would suggest. Or is it a chicken and the egg? What comes first, wisdom or transcendence?
That's an interesting way of putting it. But you see, transcendence is only a word which I have used very much to represent the absolute. Because these words, absolute, God, and so on, they have become so loaded now.
If we use Buddha nature, Buddha nature is wisdom. It's not a question of before or after. They're in the same context as that.
You see, when talking of these things, which belong to the context of the infinite and the eternal, our difficulty is that we always introduce words which belong to the other context, the context of the finite and the temporal. And this is the great difficulty with talking. If two Buddhas met, how would they communicate?
Silence.
By?
Silence.
Yes, perfectly true.
I disagree, I think they'd have a good chat.
Huh?
What? I think they'd have a good chat.
And a good laugh. That's
a good smile, perhaps, but I don't know about laughter.
Oh, come on. It might be.
Be careful. Of course, it depends on what kind of laughter. What is the usual laughter like? A disturbance of the atmosphere.
I was thinking about... that's nice. That's nice. Disturbance of the atmosphere.
It's a disturbance of the atmosphere.
I was thinking about the monk, Zen monk, who promised not to cross the bridge and was visited by two friends in his boat, and then he came talking with them to say goodbye, and they crossed the bridge unawares, and they looked at each other and they just laughed. That kind of laughter. The laughter that
Yes, but how do you know what kind it was? Did you hear it?
I don't know even if it took place.
Yes. Going back to this question, why is it when transcendence limits itself, the first thing that is produced is wisdom? Look, now I think I've got an idea which may be helpful. There is no first, second or third in the action of transcendence. In the context of the infinite, there are no separations. The infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. There are no separations. It is only when the infinite, the eternal, limits itself, then separation comes in, you see. But the whole of the Kabbalistic presentation from Ein Sof right down to the, well, what are the,
Malkuth.
You see, Malkuth, right down to Malkuth. At Malkuth there's a difference. Then it is the world of the separate, you see. But at the transcendent levels, there is no first, second, third. We talk in terms of this, that and the other, but it is all an identity. It is an identity holding uniqueness in it. So difference can come into being later on. You see? These things are very, very difficult to conceive. We tend to let our sort of imagination, not the ordinary imagination, but a sort of a profound imagination which we are capable of, run riot. And in that process, we mix up the two contexts. The context of the transcendent itself as such, you see, and the context of the finite, temporal and mortal. We mix those two contexts up and make our mistakes. This is where practically all theologies fall down somewhere or other, because they mix up the two contexts. It's impossible to talk about that which completely transcends. We can only utter suggestive words, make suggestive sounds. And the sound in itself, the word in itself, being the language that we know, produces a certain result in our mind as such, you see. But it is a limited thing always. And we try to plaster that limited something in our minds onto the infinite. Can't be done. You see, notice the words which are used to attempt to suggest transcendence. They are all negating words of that which is not the infinite. You see. We have no positive words for that. Because separate, when consciousness can free itself, you see, can become free and realize that infinity, that eternity, you see, that is possible. But when we try to talk about it, we are always reduced to limiting terms. If we compare talking to and conceptualizing to a tailor making a suit for us, you see, talking and conceptualizing is the case where the tailor cuts off too much material and the suit doesn't fit. You see? But it is true that a sense of transcendence, once it awakens, enables us to be wary of making mistakes when we talk. Look at the way intellectualists have spoiled reams and reams of paper with ink talking about God. You see. And after they have finished all their writing, good God, said God, what have I done to deserve all this? You see. You know, the Jewish idea that you must never speak the holy word, must never utter it, you see, has great, great good sense in it, very sound sense. And yet, nowadays particularly, we have to say Yahweh, Yod, He, Vav, He, the letters as such. But having used a word like that to represent the total, the absolute reality as such, then what happens? We split it up, we spoil it all the time. Our writing on the wall is not at all the absolutely clean canvas which is empty of any splodge upon it. It's quite different. We can sense transcendence. We can do that. But when we start thinking about transcendence, then the spoiling begins. Because thought always spins cobwebs, verbal cobwebs, attempting to represent, to represent the unpresentable, the illimitable. Words like that are all right. And you'll notice that all the words which are all right with respect to the transcendent context are words which negate the limited context. You see? See, the word absolute is a very good word, isn't it? It dissolves everything. Just dissolves everything. So then, the result is that there is no thing present. Everything is limited. It has dimensions. It has characteristics. The absolute has, the transcendent has no characteristics whatsoever. We can ascribe creative power to it. Because whatever comes into being is the result of creative action in eternity. Words, you see. I mean, these words have sort of emerged with me over the years. And they have a certain feel for me. But whether the words as such, when I have written them or spoken them, have any real meaning for anyone who reads or hears, I don't know. See, this creative action in eternity of transcendence the whole transcendence is something which is perpetual, it never ceases. It may be compared to the functioning of a living body. The heart beats all your life. The bloodstream flows all your life. It's like that. Something like that. Now, when I say all your life, I'm talking in terms of time. And time has a movement to it. And that movement of time is really perhaps the movement of our own awareness, the movement of our own perceptions. What is time otherwise? We cannot have any concept of time without movement. Just because all the planets and the stars and everything move, they move, therefore we have modes, methods for understanding something which we have chosen to call time. When you are into the real deep samadhi, there is no time. It's a timeless, it's the experiencing of timelessness through your psychophysical organism. You see? But when you come out of that samadhi, and the Buddha himself used to say, about 7 days and nights. You see? Alright. When you come out of that, you're back again in ordinary everyday time consciousness. But you have experienced timelessness. And that experience of timelessness in the ultimate samadhi, the cessation, as the Buddhists put it, the Turiya state, as the Upanishads present it, is something quite indescribable. You see, the moment the psychophysical organism transcends time and space, it is in the realm of the non-descript. Non-descript, not only where words are concerned, but where concepts are concerned also. Every concept is a limited something, isn't it? Only it's a limitation in an unspoken realm. Then that concept gets transformed into words, whatever the concept may be. And so the limitations increase. So we get the fundamental meaning of materialism is the peak point, or rather the real depth, the deepest point of limitation. That is concreteness, ultimate concreteness. I don't know, these are very difficult things to talk about. One has to be very careful. Over the years, I have experienced this gradual ascesis, the real asceticism, the ascesis, the removal of all that hides, covers over that which is the real thing. If you can sense the reality of transcendence in rare moments, it can be done through meditation. It can be deliberately done as declared in Hindu and Buddhist teachings. You see, Christian teachings deny that it can be deliberately done. Certainly Saint Teresa denies that. It is said in Christian mysticism that it is granted by grace for just a flash and no more. Whereas the Buddha has openly stated over and over again, you can enter into that state and abide in it whenever you please, wherever you please, as long as you please. Whence the power to do that whenever you please, as you please, and as long as you please. The psyche, if it is utterly purified, is wholly empty, and it offers no obstruction to consciousness being completely and completely aware of the total reality. Nothing to prevent it. But the moment a concept emerges and words emerge, that state is blurred. When the Buddha said that the cessation, that ninth stage, is the cessation of perception, all perception and feeling, he didn't mean perception and feeling as you and I mean perception and feeling. Our meaning of perception and feeling is confined to the realm, the context of the finite, the limited, the temporal and the mortal, perception and feeling. All that we know of perception is that which springs up in the mind, runs its course and fades away. And we can't stop that death. You see? If we begin to sort of get a glimmering of things like this, we will appreciate the extraordinary thing that happened, that happens with the true enlightenment. All these limitations are transcended in consciousness. This is the supreme significance of man. The root of from which the word man comes is mind. Man and mind come from man. You see, the root is the Sanskrit man. Manas, mind, man. You see, it's like that. And it is, I feel, useful, shall I say, to be on the safe side. I was going to say necessary, but it is wiser perhaps to say it is useful to try and become aware, reach out towards transcendence like this. Because once you sort of get the flash, it changes your whole psyche tremendously. And so many things that worry us in life, because we function in isolative self-consciousness and split the world up into separate things and deal with them as separate things. And out of all that, there springs all the possibility of greed and aversion and illusion. And delusion, you see, all that springs out from that. This is why meditation in the real sense is of such tremendous importance. As the theists would put it, prayer. It's the same thing really, only the theists as a group, and of course they include hundreds of millions of people in the world, the theists as a group don't quite appreciate the sort of absoluteness of the transcendent state. And that is why they get limited. When, for example, we all go through different mental states, don't we? The different dhamma, if you like, the different mental states. And if one is in a bad state, don't ask me what do you mean by a bad state. If you don't know that, give it all up. You see? If you are in a bad state, instead of trying to struggle against it, Turn your attention gently, quietly, to that which is the significance of transcendence itself. And in that activity, you will find that the psychical, the bad psychical state will dissolve. And it may reform into a good state. It may. It generally does. especially if your real fundamental interest is the fulfillment of your destiny as a human being. This is very important. And you see, you will find that you will become free of a string of thoughts and a string of words, like I'm using now. You become free of all that, and you become aware of essential reality, the essence of what is. And in that, there is freedom. And in the culminating state, as the Buddha said, unshakable freedom of mind. Note, unshakable freedom of mind. In the Gita and in the Hindu writings, you find the kutastha state. You see, it's unshakable. You're like a rock, kutastha, like a solid rock, but minus the density, the denseness of the rock. It's extraordinary to think, to try to sort of feel and visualize this extraordinary intensity of the transcendent state, the transcendent awareness. It's rock-like quality, and at the same time, it's utterly subtle quality. See, this is where words begin to fail altogether. But sometimes, although words fail very largely, something can be suggestive enough to give one a glimpse of, that is something of the nature of the transcendent. What we have to beware of is the transcendent is not there other than this. There must be no dividing up. The total reality is the absolute whole. And that is the meaning of holiness. This is where the theistic theologies which present God as the wholly other than us. The creator is wholly other than the created. This is where they fail. To start with, they fail just straightforwardly intellectually. It's a self-contradictory statement. It took people like Eckhart to jump over that hurdle. He did it remarkably successfully, so successfully that the church couldn't present him with fire.
But when you get into that state, do you know that you're in that state, or is it until you get back?
You don't know it when you are in that state.
You don't know it until you come back to this state, that you have been in that state.
Quite. But look, if you have really been there in your innermost consciousness as such, consciousness, you see, for us means to be aware of that which is other. I'm conscious of that book on a table. That is an otherness. The otherness is present. When there is no otherness whatsoever present, you see, then whilst you are in that state, the brain doesn't know it at all. And it can't know it. You see? Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad has a beautiful little passage. As when in the embrace of a beloved wife there is no consciousness of otherness at all, so in the embrace with Brahman there is the absolute absence of all divisive consciousness. This is a very important, but it is the pure absolute consciousness as such.
But then you can't stay in that state.
No, no. The human being cannot stay in that state permanently.
Could you ever? No, you wouldn't be human if you stayed in that.
Stella, what do you mean by could you ever? You are in that state, but you don't know it with the brain. When you come back from that state, when you come back means that your sense brain functioning has now once again come to the forefront. As we are at present, it's our sense brain functioning which is in the forefront, isn't it? When you come out of that transcendent sort of awareness, the Buddha called it the cessation, the Upanishads called it the Turiya state, you see, the Turiya Avastha, the fourth state as they called it. When you come out of that, then once again consciousness becomes vijnana, discriminative consciousness, and is limited to sense brain functioning. Then if the impress of that transcendent experience may affect the psychophysical organism to such a degree that thoughts which are the result of the activity of the brain using the vehicle of language, thoughts come into being which can be like shadowy photographs of that reality. That transcendent reality is utterly unspeakable, it's nondescript. You must have some sort of otherness present, some sort of separation present, in order to describe. Otherwise you can't speak about the thing. If you have become absolutely it, you see, that is to say, it has taken you completely into itself. As put in, I think, in Christian terms, and the God and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. When that occurs, then that is an absolute thing. But when you come back to your ordinary manhood state or womanhood state as such, and the impress on the psychophysical organism has been sufficiently strong, the brain will be able to talk about it. But what we say is a smudgy picture. But there's no harm in using even a smudgy picture, provided we realize that this is how it seems at the moment. Let it pass. Don't hold on. Don't grasp it. This is where the Buddha's teaching of be free from grasping is so important. It's extraordinary.
That would be the danger.
Huh?
Want to cling to it.
Yes, that's a great danger. Never cling to any such thing. If God comes to have tea with you, enjoy the tea and enjoy God. And when he goes away, don't say, oh, he's gone away, and pine for him. And he'll come. Don't you worry. Because he's everything, you included.
All
right, let him say it. I'm not interested in what he says. I can't do anything about it.
No.
Look, have you ever tasted a ramphal or a sitaphal?
I don't know even what
it is. Exactly. So whatever you say about it just doesn't matter.
It is lovely.
You see? You see, people try to search for nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or God or Brahman or whatever it is. We don't have to search for anything at all. This has to be rendered empty. That is to say, it's not empty in the sense of null and void. Far from it. It has become so sensitive, so pure, that it is utterly unresisting. It can't prevent transcendence functioning through it. And then, the inspiration which comes when that sort of thing happens is something absolutely extraordinary, absolutely wonderful. Saint Teresa, for instance, in the interior castle, has written rather beautifully about such things. You see? But of course, Saint Teresa, like most of the Christian mystics anyway, has definitely said that it is just granted by grace and lasts for a flash, for an instant. This is not so. The Indian holy ones have contradicted that. They say, as you please, when you please, and as long as you please, you can remain in that state. Of course, that can be challenged, because there comes a time when the body has to be fed, it has to eliminate, and so forth, you see. So so you can't stay permanently in that. You can stay for a limited time.